Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Henrik. Welcome back. I hope you had a good weekend. RedEyesCreations.com, RedEyesRadio.net, and RedEyesMembers.com is the websites. We've been staying busy over the weekend with new shows and upcoming updates, chipping away at all the things that must be done to keep Red Eyes moving forward and growing. So today we are speaking with an insider who is on the front lines of the migrant waves trying to push into Britain. Adam is a firefighter working for the Kent Fire and Rescue Service, assigned at the Eurotunnel fire station there. And today we're going to get the inside scoop on what has been happening in the tunnel since the floodgates opened completely during the summer of 2015, as he, together with his colleagues, are on the front line getting the blunt end of dealing with people trying to get from the continent in Calais, France, over to the benefits in the UK. It's one extended segment today. We have modified his voice slightly also, so it's supposed to sound a bit different. Just so you're aware of that, we are doing this in order to help protect his identity for fear of losing his job for speaking out and sharing all of this with us, which makes us extremely grateful that Adam takes the risk that he does so that we may get an insight into the madness at the Eurotunnel. Hi, Adam. Thank you so much for coming on the program and deciding to reach out. It's great to speak with you today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Say, I've been a fan of the show for many years and Radio 314 as well. And after hearing you recently talking about getting people on to give any help, I thought I would let you know the information that I have.
Absolutely, and we really appreciate that, Adam, you know, because this is a super important topic. It's something that I've wanted to address for a long time, you know, in terms of what has been happening at the Eurotunnel, and it's really good to have, you know, an insider, if you will, with us, who actually have seen some of the things from the inside to be able to speak with someone like you. And you've obviously shared over email some of the story and what's been happening and how you've been involved over the last few years, I believe. So I wanted to dive into that more here today and speak about that. So first, just give us a kind of a little bit of a background of what you've been working with there and how long you've been involved, you know, more or less in one way or another with what's happening at that tunnel between Dover and Calais that connects France with the UK and effectively connecting England or Britain to the continent as well.
Right, yeah. I've been a firefighter down at Eurotunnel, but I actually work for Kent Fire and Rescue Service, and we have a permanent station at Eurotunnel. I've been there for quite a few years now, and the way the system works is that we as firefighters only deal with incidents at the Eurotunnel site. From the day I arrived there, we've always heard about the migrants, illegal immigrants, and they used to always refer to them as clandestines because they always tried to come across secretively. We'd always heard about them, and we speak to the police and immigration officers and people that come through our station, and they'd always told us that there was usually about 10 a day that they came across. This was leading up to 2015. But our main role down there is for the protection of the people of that use the Eurotunnel. If there's stopped trains or incidents underground, fires on trains, which there's been a few of, that's our main role. It was never to deal with any of the migrants.
So there has been a few fires, huh?
Yes, yeah, there's been three in total. Two real major ones and another, a small one.
Oh, interesting. There you go. So when did you get involved in, I guess your work has changed then over the last year, really, right? Your tasks have become very different than your normal ones, I figure.
Yes, definitely. We were never involved in anything to do with the searching or looking for migrants in the tunnel. The fire service throughout the whole of the United Kingdom has always tried to remain a neutral body of people. So we will help everyone regardless. You know, we will cut drunk drivers out of cars. You know, we're not there to judge people. But 2015, from August onwards, there was just a huge explosion of immigrants coming in to the tunnel on trains, on foot, that the UK Police and Immigration Services, the French Police and Immigration Services, Eurotunnel's own security personnel just was swamped, just could not cope. So Eurotunnel then basically came across and said, well, the firefighters are there, they can do it, they can help. So we then ended up being pulled into this role of searching trains, searching the tunnels whenever they requested us to do so, even though it was never part of our role.
Were you ever briefed on this, Adam? You know, that they said either as a I'm not talking now about when your tasks change, we can get to that later, but before this started happening, was there any rumors within the different, what do we call them, departments, divisions, basically, that knew that something like this were going to happen?
We didn't hear of anything, rumors or anything of that nature. We sort of guessed that it may come to that because we'd been sent underground a couple of times to stop trains, and that's all we were told. You're going to a stop train, so we attend. At that point, we then found out that that's because they suspected there was migrants on the train, at which point the police dealt with those few. We then came out, and eventually we said, well, you know, what happens one day when there isn't any police? So are we going to be dealing with it? And no one ever really answered that question for us at that time. So, no, we didn't really, it wasn't really covered that well.
Right, right. So then when your tasks changed, tell us a story there and what you were told, and then later we can get into some of the things that you've actually seen. And I guess this is just in the recent year then, right?
Yes, yeah, literally. This 2015 was the year that it all changed dramatically for us. We say from the time that I'd got there, we'd spoken to immigration officers, and they usually caught round about 10 migrants a day on lorries in the UK terminal. So they'd made it through from France, they got to UK, and then they'd give themselves up basically, and that was ticking over around about 10 a day for years and years and years. There's a similar amount were coming through on ferries and whatever else way they can get into the country. But in 2015, in the July of 2015, the French ferry workers went on strike. This was over the UK, or the Eurotunnel having to sell off their ferries that they owned, because Eurotunnel actually owned two ferries, and the competition people said that they got to sell them. So the French ferry workers went on strike, so there was no ferries running that particular day, and the whole of the area was then snarled up with traffic in France. Traffic wasn't getting onto ferries. It then tried to get into the Eurotunnel, and it couldn't do that because they were just overwhelmed with traffic. The migrants then had suddenly lost their route that they were doing on a regular basis, which was sort of sneaking into the backs of lorries subversively at night. They were always trying to do it sort of quietly and undercover, and there was always this bit of sneakiness about it. But on this particular day, that sort of ended for them, so that the official reports that the UK press put out, that 1,500 migrants stormed the Eurotunnel site itself, got onto the site, through the gates, over the fences. But talking to the police officers afterwards, they estimate it was closer to sort of 3,000 migrants. They were literally running down the sides of the trains as they were pulling out. The trains were around about half a mile in length. They could probably have 50 heavy goods vehicle lorries on them. So they're quite long trains. When they start, they obviously creep along quite slowly for a while. So they literally run along beside them, jump on the train. Once the train enters the tunnel, they've then got 25 to 30 minutes on the train in the tunnel to get themselves inside a lorry. And they that's what they did for a good few hours until Eurotunnel eventually had to stop running the trains, the freight trains. They carried on with the passengers because they're a different style of train. They can't get on those. So they stopped running the freight trains that day for 24 hours. Just because they just couldn't cope with the quantity of people that were getting through the tunnel. So for us, that was the first real day of change, because the immigration services, the police services, they ended up with just so many people they've run out of police cells, they've run out of the immigration have holding cells down at Dover. They're everywhere was just full. So at that point, they were then overwhelmed themselves, and we were then tasked then to search trains.
It's kind of strange, though, isn't it? Because obviously on the French side, when you have about 3,000 people amassing on that end of things, there must have been people seeing this right on the French side. That it's kind of strange that it just came out of the blue like that, at least for you guys, right?
Yeah, it is strange. Eurotunnel were a business that just are 100% focused, I suppose, like any big business, on making money. So they do not want to stop running trains at any cost.
Right.
And so, which is what their goal is. The police at the Eurotunnel French side, the French police there and the French immigration services had obviously been used to dealing with people trying to sort of sneak on quietly. So I don't know how many there are in total down there, but this particular day, there's certainly not 3,000 police officers there. So 3,000 migrants just literally ran past them and made their way around them. Later that day, or the following day, the UK government had one of their COBRA meetings where the government all gets together in the case of an emergency, and they pledged money to the French, and the French shipped in, I think, 300 or 400 more police officers to deal with it. But again, this didn't touch the surface, and these mass invasions carried on for a good few more weeks after that.
Now, I definitely want to speak more about that. Let's just go back a little bit in the history here, because the build, the tunnel was done in 94. It was started in 88, and I think it came out, I was reading a bit about it, the project came out about over 80% over its predicted budget, which is, of course, quite a bit. So I can understand that they wanted to run trains no matter what, right? But there was another refugee camp there. I think it was actually closed in 2002, but the San Gate, I don't know if I'm saying that correctly.
Yes.
Right? I don't know if you were working there at that time. Do you remember that?
Yes, the Sangat, that's how we pronounce it in Kent. I don't even know if that's the correct French pronunciation, but the Sangat camp was built by the French government in the period from about 2005 onwards. But again, just because of the migrants. At this stage, they were a lot more Eastern European migrants from Kosovo and that sort of area. They were the main people travelling up, getting to Calais, and then they created this camp that's now got the nickname the Jungle, but they still had a similar camp. And then the French built a detention centre at Sangat, which they used to house them in, but they were not under arrest, and they weren't being deported anywhere. They were just being held there. So, of course, each day a few would try to get onto lorries, and that's why the amount was sort of 10 per day ticking over. But then they closed that camp, and because of the way the EU borders worked, I suppose, that the migrants coming from Kosovo and all those sorts of areas down the Balkan area died down. And it's been replaced now with this other wave of migrants.
Middle Eastern, North African.
Exactly.
Primarily, yeah. Tell us a bit, too, before we really start talking about some of the stories and things you've seen here, how the tunnel looks, right? I think there's two train tunnels, and then there is one central maintenance one, right? And has there been migrants in all of these? Obviously, if they try to get on the train, they're going to be in those tunnels, but they have the ability to actually run on foot, I believe, as well, correct?
Yeah, the main entrance for the migrants to get in is through the main, they call them the running tunnels. There's one that is the northbound, which goes to France from the UK, and the southern one that goes from France to the UK. And then there's the central service tunnel that runs through the middle. The service tunnel has got security and airlock doors on it, so this isn't a route in for anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But once you're on a train and you're inside the running tunnel, you can get from the running tunnel into the service tunnel through emergency doors. Again, in case there is ever an incident underground and the people have to evacuate very quickly, they can then get into the service tunnel to a place of safety. So on a couple of occasions, when trains have stopped, migrants have got off the trains, pressed the buttons, opened the cross passage doors, which are large steel doors that separate the service and the running tunnel, and got into the running tunnel. But they also, there are walkways either side of the main running tunnel itself. They're only very narrow, sort of 18 inches, 2 foot wide, but they go all the way through.
I see. Okay. Now, tell us more then about some, how, I guess, you know, kind of run through from the beginning for us, that first day that you can remember when all of this kind of unfolded and what started, and tell us about some of the stories that you've seen and some of the measures of what both the Eurotunnel, but also the police have tried to do to remedy this. I guess there's a lot of failed attempts at trying to alter the situation that in some cases actually have made it worse, but kind of, yeah, just back it up for us and tell us as much as you'd like, Adam.
Okay. Basically, when we get sent from our station, it's about a 50-minute journey driving through the service tunnel to get to the end where the trains come to a stop. The trains usually pull up about 1 to 2 kilometres inside the tunnel, and this is where we've been sent to on this particular day. We arrived. The cross passage door was open. There was around about 20 migrants already inside the service tunnel, just sat down with a bottle of water waiting to be taken back to France, with one Eurotunnel security guard with them. We were then told by the Eurotunnel security guard that was there that the police were searching one end of the train, and we had to go in and search the remainder of the train. We have had one of our managers question this with Eurotunnel and said this isn't a job of ours. We should only really be helping people that are injured, trapped, things of this nature. And he basically ended up with a threat of, you either do it or we will remove your security pass and you will lose your job.
Yeah.
So we then went and carried out this searching.
So this is the government that has the ultimate jurisdiction here, then, not Eurotunnel, right?
No, the government issues the government does our security checks, our background checks on us, but Eurotunnel, they own the security pass that allows us onto the site. So if they remove your security pass, there's no way for you to be able to get to your place of work. So they ultimately have the control over you. Even though I work for Kent Fire and Rescue Service, if Eurotunnel take that pass off me, there's nothing that can be done about that, and I just then have lost my job.
They
just use this as a threat for many, many reasons, not just that one, but for anyone that works for Eurotunnel. If they lose their pass, they're out of a job. But, so this particular day, we then started to walk down the length of the train on this little side passageway, and the migrants are hidden. They hide themselves under the lorries, in the infrastructure of the train itself, on top of lorries. So it's all quite involved searching for them. It takes a long time looking. You know, imagine there's 50 articulated lorries on a train in the dark. It all takes quite a bit of time. The one thing is these guys that have been living in this jungle for weeks now, or months, or even years, some of them, they have been burning plastic and things to cook their food on, and they you can smell them, like the smell of like bonfire. So you can get a whiff of them a long time before you even see them. But we walked along, and we saw several. We're not equipped with anything that the police have, so we don't have stab vests, we don't have handcuffs, CS gas, or anything else to protect ourselves in case any of these people become violent. And we just literally just point where we want them to go and ask them to go there. And if they do, they do. If they don't, I don't really know what would happen. But
Has that happened? Have you had problems? Because when you wrote to me, you said that many of them have knives, if not everybody. Some of them have become violent, and I think there have been cases of people getting hurt, right?
Yes, yeah. We we have voiced our concerns throughout to our management on several occasions, and that our management have sort of ignored us on the fact that they don't want them to confront Eurotunnel about it. But we have heard there's been definitely one French police officer and one Eurotunnel security guard that were both pushed over and sort of roughed up a bit by a few of these migrants who they had thought they were quite close to the midpoint, the halfway across the channel. If they get across that midpoint, they're in the UK. So they then get to the housing and the benefits and the other things that they think they're going to get or they are going to get when they get here.
Mm-hmm.
If they get caught on the French side, they usually just get taken straight back out, taken out the gate, kicked off the site. So they've got to try again. So this
it's amazing, though, that they don't deal with these people. Right? And it's like, you're here illegally, you need to enter out of Europe, right? It's just like, it's just pushed to the side to let someone else deal with it, you know?
Completely. And what they think they're going to do, I mean, if they get kicked out of the Eurotunnel site once, do they think, oh, well, I'm just going to go back then? I'm going to give up? No, they just try again and again and again. And so it goes on. We have heard from someone else who I work with who's father-in-law is a lorry driver, of lorry drivers in France having fights and being injured because the migrants, they've got two techniques that they use to getting in the lorries. They either carry a knife and literally cut through any straps or the tarpaulin sidings, or they carry around about, it's a sort of 12-inch long piece of rebar, metal bar, and they use that to just smash the padlocks off the backs of the lorries and get in that way. So they are all carrying either a knife or a lump of iron bar to gain access to the vehicle. So they are carrying some sort of concealed weapon. So we try to remain as far away from them as possible and just direct them to the service tunnel. Most of them go willingly. All the ones that I've seen have just gone willingly. One guy that I saw who, whether he had done this before and he'd learned from being caught and taken out, but he actually took down his trousers and defecated into his own hands and then rubbed that over his hands and his wrists and his arms. And I was stood sort of open-mouthed looking at this thinking, what's going on? And later on, a police officer explained to me, he said, oh, the reason he's done that is so that we can't hold him or we can't handcuff him because we're going to become sort of contaminated. So he knows then that he's going to be left alone and just told to go places. He's not going to be detained in any way.
Wow. That's amazing. So, yeah, they know we don't want those cooties, right? So, God, that's amazing. What... So, okay, the reason then most of them go willingly is because by the time you see them, they are on the British side, which means that then they, as you said, they will be, I guess, taken care of in a different way than they, if they're still stuck on the French side, correct?
No. Unfortunately, it's completely the opposite. They if they get to the UK side, then they are really buoyant and happy. No, when we see them, most of them are still on the French side, but they're just... Because absolutely nothing happens to them, it's just a shrug of the shoulders and we'll try again. So most of these people, a lot of them are exhausted, I think, because they've been trying to get across for weeks and weeks.
Uh-huh.
There's from the police and immigration services, they estimate that 150 now a day make it across. So that must mean there are hundreds and hundreds of attempts every day. So these guys that are getting caught, they just get escorted to the nearest gate, let go. They then, if it's too late or they can't be bothered anymore, they go and have a little rest and try again later. If they're not, if it's only the first time they've been caught that day, they'll go back and try again. So no, the ones that make it through to the UK side are usually quite jubilant, and we don't see them anymore because they're taken away and into the UK system.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, lots to talk about here, but let's go back to the lorry drivers for a little bit, because I've heard horror stories and the way they've been threatened. And I believe as well that this is what's interesting here, because I think it's a matter of, you know, one blaming the other kind of thing, because I think they've done it so that the lorry drivers are actually responsible for the cargo that they take over, right? So that if they get found out with an immigrant on board, I don't know what to call it, but then they are actually fined. Is that correct?
Yes, yeah, that is correct. They get, I think it's £1,000 fine. I may be wrong, it may be €1,000, but I think the fine is given to them when they get to the UK. So if they end up with a migrant on their vehicle, it gets through the tunnel, and they then get stopped by the police or immigration service, and they've got five migrants, that's a £5,000 fine. So over in France, the lorry drivers either like to keep moving, keep their vehicle going as fast as it can till they can get onto the terminals, or just try and avoid the areas where the migrants are. But if the migrants are on the Eurotunnel site itself, they then run alongside the train, get on the train, break into the lorry. The lorry driver's not even in his lorry at this stage. He's in the vehicle car that the Eurotunnel provide for all the lorry drivers. And then
so clarify that. So the lorries actually drive up on the train and are transported through.
That's right. Yeah, okay. Drive up onto the train. Then the drivers get out the lorry and they go to an amenity car, and they all sit in an amenity car. And their vehicle is then on the train, and then they're right at the other end of the train in a little car where they can have a drink and a sandwich. And then so these migrants could that physically at that point break into their lorry. And the driver wouldn't even know. He'll just go back to his lorry at the end of his journey, get off, drive out, and can be caught with the migrants. But
yeah.
I don't think that same fine applies to Eurotunnel. So if a train gets through with 20 migrants on it, Eurotunnel doesn't receive a £20,000 fine. So they're not too worried. It's the lorry drivers that get the fine.
So they are ultimately the one who has to take. They're kind of on the front end, really, of this now, then, because they have to make sure none of them are on board, that none of them are let onto it. Because I've heard, I think it was just, I don't know if anybody has been killed yet, but it was almost like it's a matter of time. So some drivers have been, hurt pretty bad. They've been attacked. They've been cut with knives, etc. And I remember reading for months and months about this. Out of the UK press. What have you seen? What kind of stories do you know here that has happened?
It's very similar. It's escalating. That's the thing. To be at the beginning, say perhaps 12 months, 14 months ago, if a lorry driver went to the back of his lorry and it had been opened, the migrants would jump out and run away because they were still that level of that they were doing something wrong. But since July last year, there's now a level of confidence in them that nothing happens. So they don't want to get off the lorries, so they will fight to try and keep their space or stay on where they want to go. We've discussed this ourselves at the station, and we have said if someone or if a group of 20 of them, when we go underground, there's 8 firefighters in total. So if there's 20 migrants and they think that they are within a few hundred metres of the midpoint, there's nothing to stop them from going for it. You know, and you think, well, am I going to fight and put my life or my well-being at risk just to stop them?
But, right. Well, think about this, folks, as well. I mean, who has the incentive here? Who is in the position of being more desperate? So, I mean, we're talking about people who just are going to their job. They might not be that invested in it beyond the fact that it's obviously their livelihood when they do a good job. I'm not saying that, but the people trying to cross in, they are in a level of desperation which is unmatched by the other side, shall we say. So it's a really dodgy situation for them.
It is, yes. And also the thing for the fire service as well, I know from my whole career has been that 99% of the time when I turn up, everyone's pleased to see us because we're there to help them. They've either had a fire in their house or a car accident. But these people aren't pleased to see us. They want us out of their way. And so that we are still playing by a sort of old-fashioned set of rules, and they're not anymore.
Wow, it's amazing. And I mean, the blame here has to be put on, I mean, the inept behavior on behalf of the government and the border enforcement, that the basically there is not a clear message here that if you cross in, you do not get to stay, right? That doesn't exist anymore. This is the very reason why the boats are coming. And when the boats are coming, in many cases, those are ultimately the people that you know, we get to see up in Germany and Sweden and Britain as well.
Yes, exactly. One of the other examples I can give you is just recently been on the news in the UK, a Sudanese migrant who a train came to a complete stop. I was actually there that day, and he got off the train and ran up the running tunnel, the tunnel that the train is in. So the train stopped and he just ran off. Well, we were then tied up for a little while searching the train. One of the other firefighters I worked with noticed a set of footprints in the dirt and dust on the furthest platform away or walkway from where we were. This is somewhere that's really dusty and dirty because unless you're a maintenance worker, on a rare occasion, no one goes down there. So a set of footprints was really obvious. And I can then, it is incompetency on the behalf of the fire service, the police, immigration, and Eurotunnel. But we had a man who was perhaps 2 kilometres at the beginning of a 50-kilometre-long tunnel. He was inside a concrete tunnel, and for 4 or 5 hours, we didn't manage to find him or catch him. And he walked right the way through the tunnel, or ran, or whatever he did. But he got completely out to the UK side and gave himself up. He was arrested and charged with trespassing, and there's a really old, from about the 1850s, a law of endangering a train, and he was charged with all these different things. Well, that was way back in August, September time, might have been a bit later, might have been October, but he was then put in a claim for asylum. And we've just literally, it was on the news in the last few days that his asylum claim has been met. So he's now a proper legal immigrant in the UK. But at the same time, all the charges against him have been dropped.
Yeah.
So even though he's now legally allowed to stay here, they're saying that he didn't commit any crimes either. So This is just going to spread a message to the other migrants in the camps that really nothing happens to you.
It's amazing. I wonder what changed. I wish I realized or could understand where this message all of a sudden was given, because it seems that it was just one day, you know, this past summer here, last year, it just opened and no one could do anything. They tried a little bit here and there, but I mean, we've seen other border footage from, you know, Macedonia and Greece and into some of the, you know, Serbian, Slavic, you know, Balkan countries down there. And we've seen these people just pour over and the police are helpless. They can't do anything. They won't do anything. And obviously this is the fault of, as I said, the government, because they haven't taken a strong stance on this where they say, you know, if you cross, you don't get to stay, you're out, that's it, don't even try. I mean, we've talked about it before on the show, but Australia has done that when it comes to the boats. They've literally, you know, blown up boats, and this has effectively managed them to stop this from happening because a clear signal has been sent. In this case, there was manuals that was found, road maps and everything of like that someone had printed out and given to these migrants and said, well, you know, go to this place if you need help, go here. It was like all along the way up to Northern Europe. And so the signal is like, come on in, you're invited, basically. So,
yeah, so that's from how I see it as an individual that lives in Kent, once they get here, there is every single opportunity is given to them. They have they have translators and assistants, and they are then told exactly what forms to fill out to get what benefits. So it literally, they just need to get 1 foot over the borderline, and that's it then.
Yeah.
But that doesn't, that the way that the UK is set up, obviously with giving them the money, is one of the reasons they're coming through Europe. But even if they don't get here and they're in Europe, they're here in the European Union without permission.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, what happened to that? I mean, the whole of the European Union has been a legal body which is just unprecedented in European history, and it's been about the enforcement of, you know, ridiculous laws such as what angle a cucumber or a banana should have, you know, ridiculous agriculture laws like that. But in this case, it all just comes crumbling down, and no one is enforcing the law, you know.
Yeah, so that's exactly how we see it. The French are saying that, you know, the UK should allow them in, and the UK is saying, well, they're in French soil, so they should be dealt with by the French. But ultimately, they shouldn't be on anyone's soil.
That's absolutely right. So what is happening when it comes to, let's say, what kind of leverage, I guess, do you have when it comes to the union? There has to be some firefighters union or something that put pressure on the government, that ultimately can put pressure on the Eurotunnel company or corporation. What's happening there? Has there been rumors and movements of over the fact that you guys are discontent that you're in this position to take the blunt end of this?
The Fire Brigade Union, the FBU, is nationally been quite a strong union for many, many years, probably one of the last ones left. So we're probably on the government's radar. But one of the things that they have done, again, nationally, is protect firefighters from their own employers, and to protect their jobs, to make sure that they're only carrying out the jobs that they're paid for, trained for. Dealing with the illegal immigration is definitely not a job that we've been trained for or equipped for. And as such, the union has opposed this with our senior management. Our senior management have a party line of you don't deal with immigration. You're literally there. If someone is trapped or if someone is injured, that's all you do. But that's their public face. Then the private face that we see through Eurotunnel is, if you don't help us with this and you don't do it, you will lose your security pass and then subsequently your job. So we go back, we tell the union, this is what the threats we've been given. Senior management say, no, that doesn't happen. But it, and round it goes.
Yeah.
So no one yet has been brave enough to completely test the water and say that they're not doing it.
What is the general atmosphere like among your co-workers?
It's not great. We've had a great many changes in the fire service, not only with the migrants, but we've had cutbacks in general, same as most of public services throughout the whole of the world, I should imagine.
Yeah.
So public opinion, our own opinion of our bosses is not at the best, but we certainly don't feel as a group at Eurotunnel that we have any support from our own managers. And we certainly don't feel that we would get any support whatsoever from Eurotunnel. So it's literally a case of do as you're told or find something else.
Now, you mentioned the one that defecated in his hands and rubbed this all over himself to avoid it. There is a real clear, you know, danger here of diseases as well. Tell us a bit about this, and have you been... Again, have you been briefed on this? Have you been given some information, or is this what you guys have managed to gather along the way?
Yeah, again, we've had no clear direction. The reason that we have everything in the fire service has a way of operating it, a manual, a health and safety risk assessment. So even just carrying items of equipment, someone's has assessed, and it's all documented. Well, for them to have assessed the risk of disease would then mean that there's documentation that we are dealing with the immigrants. And as they say that we're not dealing with the immigrants, they can't have that. So we have had no direction into what or what we shouldn't be doing. We know from speaking to the police and the immigration officers that they used to mainly be based at Dover docks, but they're now increasingly spending most of their time at Eurotunnel, that they have received inoculations for hepatitis A and hepatitis B, and tuberculosis is another one, and because a lot of the migrants are coming over that have got those diseases. I personally don't want to be receiving endless amounts of inoculations because of what's in the inoculations.
But, yeah, you've been listening to our show, right? You know what that is about. Yeah, exactly. But have they offered you this though?
No, definitely not.
Okay.
We have not been offered it because, again, they would have to recognise then that we were dealing with these people. The immigration services have also told us that that 99% of their migrants suffer from scabies, the skin disease, mm-hmm. which is the little mites, and that's extremely contagious. And again, there's no real inoculation against that apart from protecting yourself against it and keeping your distance, really.
Well, Britain is an island. I mean, think about that, too. I mean, Australia has really hard restrictions on what you can carry in. We're actually in a similar situation in Sweden because it's really Scandinavia is really a peninsula and it separates us from the continent just as Britain. And you'd think, again, legally, that there would be really hard measures here not to bring in a bug or a, you know, some kind of insect or bacteria or something that could upset the biosphere, if you will, of Britain. So, you'd think that they would be concerned about this stuff, right?
You would. I mean, because there's not only the curable or treatable diseases. There's the other diseases that are coming into the country, which are costing the NHS a lot of money. Which a lot of the African migrants have got HIV and AIDS, and this is only what I've read in the local and the national newspapers here. That just the migrants coming from Africa are costing our health service nearly £1 billion a year just to treat them for HIV and AIDS.
Yeah.
That's the ones that they know. Obviously, a lot of illegal migrants don't show up. They don't appear. So they may just be living with the disease themselves, wherever it is they've managed to get to. So that's quite a major disease coming into the country.
Yep. Similar things in Sweden. We've seen the increase of different kinds of lice and different kind of parasitical bugs that are brought with the migrants. And the state is simply too inept because for fear of political incorrectness that they don't even recognize that this happens. They don't dare to recognize that, yes, some of these people that come, they have lice with them. They have diseases. They carry things. But it's like they don't dare to touch it because if you could begin to talk like that, it could be offensive potentially to somebody. So let's just drop our guard and let's just hope that the whole, you know, ecosystem doesn't just shut down because of it.
Yeah. So that's the diseases that we know of, you know, that we have no real idea of what's coming in on the clothing or in any bags that they may bring either.
Yeah, well, look at, I mean, it's like we know the Black Plague was brought in from Asia in the, in the Middle Ages, and this caused a huge die-off of the European population. The same thing happened when the Europeans went over to America, right? And so it's still, we haven't, I guess they have a faith that they can fix everything with vaccines and inoculations or whatever, but that's not necessarily true. This could have really dire consequences, and they could bring with them diseases that, we might not be that accustomed to in Europe, so it could have you know, major consequences. We just don't know yet.
No, that's right. And I say so I only know of the ones the main ones spoken about, like the tuberculosis, but that's on the increase in the UK, which 20 years ago had virtually disappeared.
Yeah, so it's being imported into our countries. It's amazing, isn't it? All of this seems to have just fallen to the wayside in terms of, saving all of these people and caring more for them than for our own. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you, there are many components here, many things that you told me about that I want to get to. But one of them is you told me about a fence that there have been some measures, from the authorities' point of view that, okay, let's try to remedy you this, whatever. Tell us about that story and what happened with this new fence they tried to build.
Yeah, that all stemmed again from this major day in in July, August, where the ferry guys went on strike and the invasion was just immense over a period of 3 or 4 days. And the UK government met and had their COBRA meeting. And one of the things they did was they pledged £12 million to the French government to help build a better fence along a 12-kilometre stretch of the perimeter. The perimeter of the French terminal is 23 kilometres all the way round. But this particular 12-kilometre stretch is the side that borders where the jungle camp is. So over the next few months, they built, the companies went in and they erected this new fence. Well, it's about 4 or 5 metre high steel fence with razor wire on the top. And we found out, speaking to police, French police officers, months and months later, that the migrants had developed a technique where they get pieces of, it's like coat hanger wire, about 300 millimetres foot long. They bend the end over into a tiny little sort of half centimetre hook. They make 5 or 6 of these. They lay them down the length of their forearm and onto the palms of their hands. And then just using ordinary duct tape them onto their hands and their wrists. They then use them like claws to hook onto the fencing. And they just literally scale up the fencing, throw an old blanket over the razor wire like they probably did in the old World War II movies, and right. Jump over.
Yeah.
And the police told us that they actually could climb the new fence faster than the old fence.
Oh, my God. Of course. Yeah, so, of course. Wow. That's amazing. If there's a will, there is a way. If only that drive existed to, like, try to, you know, remedy some of the the areas that they actually come from. Because, let's face it, many of these people, they don't come from war-torn countries. There are other things that have caused these countries to fail. Because, I mean, let's connect this with the statistics and the, you know, who it is that is arriving as well, right? I mean, what age are they? What gender are they? Is there any, you know, unaccompanied children? And if there are children, what age are they? And what can you tell us about that?
Well, so again, most people can see it for themselves if they actually watch the news when it is reported. And most of the UK news only ever shows any of the problems in France. They never really show anything in the UK. But all of the people that come are all men, aged anywhere from, all the ones that I've seen, anywhere from sort of 15 up to about 45. So I've been there many, many years. And in all that time, I've only ever come across one woman.
Really?
Just one woman.
Wow.
There are others that get, but in my time, I've seen lots and lots of migrants and hundreds, and most of them are all men aged between 15 and 45. The small children that they find to film out in the camp in Calais, I've never seen them of that age. So when they get across and when they come through, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We have someone who that I know works for the National Health Service in the UK, and she actually works in the department that deals with vulnerable children. So children whose parents can't look after them properly anymore or at risk of injury or abuse. They get rehoused by the Kent County Council into to the care system. And she said that they used to rehouse, I think it was between 100 and 150 children from Kent a year. That was their average. And this year alone, 2015, just migrants, there's been 980. So just under 1,000 migrants have come into our system that are what they call unaccompanied adults. The press has a way of showing it on the news of, they show a picture of a 5-year-old little girl smiling at the camera. But
yeah.
But most of these people are anyone under the age of 18. So most of them are boys, 15, 16, 17 years of age. And also they don't have passports or papers because that's how they're not being sent back. So they could even be older than that and claim that they're 18 or 19.
Of course, yeah. So you see it all. We see it all the time. Yeah, go ahead.
So they then have been put into the care system because under UK government law and the policy is anyone under the age of 18 is a child. So they turn up, say, yeah, I'm only 15 or I'm 16, and then they go to the care system. But what that's done is that now has forced the care system to send the children in Kent that need care outside of our county to other counties because they can't cope. So, they're snowed under.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen photos in the Swedish press of what they say is accompanied children, and they are, I mean, clearly they have wrinkles and more or less a full beard, and they're, you know, some of them are even balding. You know, it's like, come on, you know, it's like, this is not, it's so disingenuous. It's amazing. Yes. And they can say whatever, exactly. They can say whatever that, oh yeah, I'm 17 or I'm 18 or whatever. And no one is questioning them because again, that would be simply too offensive. It, you know, from our point of view, they've already gone through the, you know, unspeakable horrors that we can't even imagine. So us for even to question them would be like a crime in itself, right?
Yes, that's right. And I say that the UK press especially has a way of portraying, say, that a 5-year-old girl was looking at the camera, and the people that I've spoken to, you say, do you really think that this girl, unaccompanied, has come thousands of miles across Europe, has made it onto a train, and now has turned herself in? It's, no, of course not.
Yeah,
it's not happening.
No, they're manipulating us with these very well placed ads, as it were, in the papers and in these news coverages that they do of this. That's definitely clear. You also wrote about what has been happening locally in Kent. Some of the people that live close to the Eurotunnel. What is happening there? What have you heard there?
Yeah, so for many years with the tunnel being where it is, when the migrants come across, when the lorries that they're on pull up for services or a break, they then disembark and off they go. Well, when that was sort of 10 people a day, most of them were heading off and going off to the places where the benefits were. But now, with it being upwards of 100 to 150 a day, these people are jumping off the lorries wherever they come to a stop and disappearing into the local areas. A lot of them hand themselves in straight away and try and get themselves into the benefit system. A lot of them also are still wary of authority or not certain if they're going to get sent back. So literally just go and camp out and hide in the local woods and the local areas. And people that I know that live along the coastal area from Folkestone, sort of 30 miles in each direction, there a lot of them, it's a farming communities and small villages, and the increase of migrants that are just sleeping rough has increased. And the farmers have noticed an increase in theft of livestock, animals and mm-hmm. sheep and chickens and
yep.
things of that nature, but also petty theft, stuff out of garden sheds and garages and cars has gone missing because they need stuff to sell to get money. So the government's, the police's statistics, sorry, the local police, before 2015, so even before the major assault, the crime caused by migrants has gone up 25% in Kent alone. And that was before the major assault in 2015 in August, which that must have gone up skyrocketed because that was when the real surge came. So, people in the local area have noticed a huge amount of just small amounts of crime just taking over, really.
Amazing. We had, I think we've had occasions where I've read these stories. I forget exactly what country they were out of now, but, you know, we have these various kind of nature, small pockets of a little nature that can be a little pond or there can be geese in there. In some cases, there are other animals, like a miniature kind of petting zoo or something in certain areas. And I remember this one story where all the geese in this area were trapped and eaten by migrants. And in Sweden, we have this, in Gothenburg, actually, we have this fairly large petting zoo. And this was a couple of months ago. There's a story about this goat that had been actually had been burnt and raped, and it was like this. I'll link to the story, folks. It's unbelievable. It was unspeakable when I saw this thing of what has happened to this poor goat. And it was a young goat, and it was turned out that the animal welfare services that came and looked after it had to put it down basically because it was so badly injured. And I mean, it's just unbelievable. And clearly, I mean, no one was caught yet, I think they were on trail. But I mean, let's be honest, but that was not done by a Swedish person. I mean, I'm 100% convinced of it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, this is a different league of crimes against the animals, but I know in locally, and it, throughout the UK, they've had problems with it, but the swans have been on the decrease, and that was only reported in the press as migrants taking, killing and eating the swans, because in the UK, swans belong to the crown. So officially, only the queen is allowed to eat swans if she decides that that's what she's going to do. So that was why it made it to the press, because they were saying that these migrants are coming here and eating the queen's swans.
Oh, my God.
But there has definitely been a decrease in the swans, and I'm sure the other wild animals as well. If they're targeting the farm animals, I'm sure they're targeting the wild animals.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, for sure. We see them in some of this footage run through fields. They run over the streets, over highways, and they all. What's interesting is that many of them seem to know where they're going. You know, if I showed up in the UK, I wouldn't know where to go to get benefits or get housing or anything like that. It seems to be very, as I said before, there's maps and stuff. It seems to be very, very organized, that almost they know exactly where to go. They've been told by somebody. In some cases, they know, you know, where to keep, how long to keep their papers for. In other cases, they get rid of them. Now that's the latest development was apparently that they, you know, there has been some border checks. For example, into Sweden, there has been a check at the bridge that goes from Denmark over to from Öresund over to Malmö on the Swedish side, and they have been told, the police have been told, don't let in anybody who doesn't have, you know, some kind of papers or ID or passport or something like that. So whereas before they had actually thrown those away, now they actually are told to keep them so that they can make it in over to the Swedish side and then throw them away so that they can, you know, go to the government offices and get benefits and stuff like that. So it's very, very organized. It seems to me that it's organized anyway, Adam.
Yes, we have the system that's set up here is based in Croydon in southeast London, and all the migrants that end up coming across claiming asylum, they get shipped off eventually, but however it's done, coach loads of them or by train to Croydon and get processed there. At that point, they're given a set of papers and they go into the system of waiting for their asylum claim to be heard, which can take a couple of years. And the reason they want to come to the UK is because they start getting the UK benefits immediately. So that's their goal, is to get here and get registered at that point. But there are plenty of websites that they go on that tells them exactly what to ask for, how to ask for it. And again, these government agencies, if you go in and you ask the right question, they have to give you the right forms or the right paperwork. If you don't ask for it, you probably won't get it, but they all know exactly how to ask for it. But yeah. I have heard of stories of people getting across, they then go make their claim and they get registered. So they turn up, they say that their name is whatever their name is, they're 35 years old and they're from Iraq. And they get their papers stamped and they start claiming benefits. They then, this I don't know how much often this happens, but they have caught a few people then sneaking back out of the country again. So they go back to France, then they come back again illegally and hand themselves in a second time and get processed a second time under a different name. So they then start claiming a second lot of benefits. We have heard that. So they then are then leaving the system for two lots of benefits rather than just the one.
God, criminals, you know? Mm. Christ's sake, you know, this what this is doing to our... I remember reading stories year after year about these old British, English ladies that are freezing to death in their own houses because they can't afford to heat them. I mean, there's a lot of poor people in Britain. There are in Sweden too, but I guess we've had a little bit more of a dividing, spreading the wealth for a little bit longer, I guess. So we have been able to keep it up for a bit longer. But, you know, but England is really bad off. Let's be honest about that. And this is, you know, to do that against the local people, to exploit it like that in that capacity is just, I mean, it's beyond selfish. It's evil, you know.
It is, and say as for the poor, there are there's 980,000 families that regularly use food banks in the UK, and these are only things I've read from government sites that I know about, and just obviously the interests I have, and I think, well, they're given £12 million for a fence that doesn't work. They've also pledged, along with the French government, to build a 6-metre-high concrete wall all the way around the Eurotunnel site, which, say again, is 23 kilometres long. So that must be costing tens of millions of euros to build. And we've got 980,000 families regularly using food banks, which just doesn't seem fair, or it just seems crazy that that's happening.
Yeah, that's right. And you have, in some cases, you've had, there's other stories of Ukrainians and Russians and things like that, white migrants that have actually been booted out from some of these same countries. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the area that I live in, there's quite a lot of Polish families who came across, some of them legally, some of them illegally, back when we opened up our borders, or opened it up with Poland. And I've overheard Polish families complaining about the migrants.
Yep, I understand. Yeah,
and they're saying, yeah, they should go home and they should be
here. Yeah,
yeah.
You know. Funny, some of the biggest, and this is actually starting to happen in Sweden too, by the way. That some of the biggest anti-migrant activists are actually, you know, immigrants themselves. In some cases, they're obviously seeing that they came to a country which was functioning and working, and they benefited a lot from that, and they were actually, some of them, happy and had gratitude for that, and they're seeing that their ability to, you know, continue in that situation is diminishing the more and more people are being brought in, and the more our countries are getting bankrupt and you know, moving backwards, basically. So, yeah, I understand it.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that I look at is, as well, is the sort of the government's official net migration was up, I think, 300,000. But when you start looking at that the 600,000 or 700,000 people left the UK and 1 million arrived, but the ones that are leaving are people that are either retired or in good jobs, and then the people coming to take their places are in low-paid jobs.
Yeah.
This can only go on for so long before the society will collapse.
It's true. Exactly. Who's going to pay for all of this? We have the same thing in Sweden, where the you know, entrepreneurs and business-oriented people that are actually, you know, can end up building companies that grow large and employ people and whatnot. Those are basically through you know, the bureaucracy pushed out through, you know, super high taxes and whatnot. They end up leaving. They go to other countries. I actually do hear from some that go to London, or they go to, you know, Paris or some other country, some other areas in Europe like that. But it's true. And the replacement then that's happening is with people who are simply drained on the system and not adding into it. And mathematically, we can just figure that that's not going to work in the long run. It just doesn't work that way, you know?
No. And for the migrants coming, if one of them turns up, gets a job and is on minimum wage, there's not a single person in the UK that can live on minimum wage. So they will immediately be getting benefits or tax credits. And the more children they have, the more money they will get, because it's done per child.
That's right. So it's an incentivizing to have them breed while we basically go in the opposite direction, because we feel we can't afford to give the child the education that they need, or, you know, give them a good experience. So, I mean, the end result of this is literally population replacement. That's what's happening here.
Yes, yeah. So amount of children that your average UK family has is half, well, not even half, probably a third of the average migrant family.
Yep. Well, I mean, in terms directly of just the tunnel situation and the position that you and your co-workers are in, what do you think should be done? What level of enforcement could work? Is this something that you guys internally have been talking about? I mean, because obviously something made it work a little bit better before, then something changed, and the application of the border enforcement doesn't no longer work. So what do you think should be done? What would solve the situation?
Right, that's quite a tricky question. The thing that would stop the migrants coming here would be the immediate handout of the money. That's not necessarily going to stop all of them, and it's not going to stop them coming to Europe from anywhere else. The getting actually onto the terminal in France would be a wall or border checks, but again, that's then just going to make everyone's lives miserable, because every lorry that's going to have to come through will have to have a thorough check, and we'll just slow the whole process down. So that's not going to make it sort of viable for anyone wanting to travel through that tunnel. I am struggling to think of a way of being able to control it.
What do you think of the idea that some countries that have entered into the European Union, and specifically the Schengen zone, obviously have to begin to enforce the border wherever they are at, right? Because you guys are, seeing literally the consequences of someone who failed doing their job in, southern Italy or in Spain or something over, over the Mediterranean, basically, right? That the message has to be sent there that, do not come here because, you're not going to get in, and if you do get in, you're going to be booted right back out. But that hasn't happened. So lax, decisions on that end, way south of you guys, is something that now you're seeing you have to deal with the problems of that. That's what I'm saying. So you think there would be an interest from the British government, which is being drained financially by this, to put pressure on the European Union so that they can enforce the border down south? I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, that's the the right thing to do. If the EU, if we're going to be in the EU and the EU are going to combine together to become a strong state, then the edge of the EU is our border. We defend it. And if someone turns up on a boat across the Mediterranean, we then say, well, this is the angle you came at. You're going back. And we ship them back and drop them back on the shore. At the moment, the sort of political correctness to say, well, you can't guarantee that everyone's from that country or they may have travelled. We're playing by a very old-fashioned set of rules where we're trying to do the right thing by everybody, but we will just be swamped because they're not playing by those rules. I couldn't go to any one of their countries and say, right, I've turned up with nothing. What are you going to give me?
Right, exactly.
They'd kick me out.
They'd laugh at you, put you in jail, probably.
Yeah, more than likely.
Yeah.
But the government out, the UK government, should say, well, rather than spending tens of millions of pounds on a wall around the Eurotunnel, we should spend it on the borders in southern Italy or Greece, and make sure that when these people turn up from Turkey, we turn them straight back round again and drop them back off on the shore.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because, looking at a map of the Mediterranean, you do have from Turkey, you have over to Bulgaria and Greece, obviously. That's a huge, huge issue. And that's why you've had countries a little bit further north-west than that, like Hungary, Serbia, building fences and trying to do their part in keeping people out. I don't know what Romania has done, if anything. I think Bulgaria was trying to build some fence as well. But then from the boat side, you have, you do have, of course, Greece as well there, but you have Croatia, you have Italy, you have France, you have Spain, possibly further out from Portugal, but that's probably not that's outside of the Mediterranean, really. But it's those countries that pressure has to be put on so that they take the responsibility to enforce their, borders, basically. Because as I said, you guys don't have any power over influencing those countries. I mean, it's, and same is true for Sweden. We're getting the blunt end of something that's failing down in Greece or something. And so there has to be cooperation across the borders here, you know?
Well, there should be. So they're all part of the EU, and they should be dealing with it as a collective group and supporting those countries. Because those the migrants that come through all the Middle Eastern countries and through Turkey and then get to Greece, whenever you hear them interviewed on the press, none of them say, I'm staying here in Greece. This is great.
No.
They all say, I'm going to Germany, I'm going to the UK, I'm going to Sweden. And that's where they're heading to. And so Greece is bankrupt, as we know. So a little bit of them is thinking, well, let them go. You know, they're not settling here. So this is when the EU is not then playing by its own rules with each other.
Yeah, it's true. Well, what do you think things are going to be like here now coming? You said things are easing down a little bit over winter now because of the cold, the temperature and all that stuff. But spring and summer 2016, I mean, there has been some outrageous predictions here of what 10 million people arriving. Don't ask me how they know this and how they can even count some of these people. But this is what they're talking about now. What do you think things are going to be like? How are you only just on your, you know, small end of all of this that we're seeing going to prepare for something like this if that happens?
Well, so the it always quietens down over winter, has done for many years, and it, again this year, is the migrants through the winter nights don't necessarily want to spend hour after hour after hour getting cold and wet. So a lot of the time they then just shelter down in the jungle, make their way through the winter, and then start again in spring and summer. From the successes they had last year, and now from this Sudanese man being given his asylum and then all the charges dropped against him, I just see a huge onslaught coming. The wall being built, however long that will take, gives me an indication that the governments don't think this problem is going to go away, because they wouldn't be spending tens of millions of euros on a wall if they thought that there was a way around this problem. So, and once the wall's built, the people will just they will end up stealing fishing boats, or they will do something else.
Mm-hmm.
So, how it's going to change, I don't know, but I can just this year. Each month has slightly escalated up to the winter, and then it's died off. So once they get going again in spring, I can foresee it being, again, day after day of continual travel problems through Eurotunnel, around Kent, because the migrants will be on the trains. Sometimes they fall off, get killed, so that the whole running tunnel then has to be shut, so there's an investigation, and it just goes on and on. But as for the future, for the next year, if they stop them getting through at the tunnel, they'll either go back to China. They did recently, I think this is last week or 10 days, they stormed a ferry, and about 50 or 60 of them ended up on a ferry.
Hmm.
But the next thing to do is steal fishing boats, I suppose, for them.
Right, exactly. I mean, there has been rumors about the Schengen zone. I think, I'm trying to find it here as we speak, but I think it's up for some kind of renewal or whatnot here, and it's possibly that some countries might actually attempt to try to pull out of it in one way or another because they can't deal with everything that's happening. What do you think in this regard?
Yeah, that's going to be something. So that the Balkan countries have been putting their borders back up, which is obviously stopping the free movement of people. But then that's the whole point of having a border. The free movement of people was taken out as an agreement in the EU perhaps 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago when there wasn't migrant invasions. So
yeah,
to put the border back up until you've sorted out the problem is not a bad thing.
No, I mean, everything has borders, everything has territory in nature. This is a very natural thing. And frankly, as we said before, you know, Adam, that if we are to open the borders in this way, then there are probably people from all over the world that would be happy to come to our countries to try to get something, to get benefits and whatnot. But the reality is that this doesn't work, and it will, and it's starting to. We're seeing that now collapsing our own countries, and then we're also left in a place where, you know, we won't even be able to help other countries in the way that we have. I mean, we've been historically very, very, very generous when it comes to donations and aid to other countries and whatnot, but that's something that's completely going to shut down if this continues. So I think, you know, whether people agree with that being the right thing or not, I guess just from a, you know, reasonable point of view of looking at it for what it is, that in itself, which many people appreciate, is going to be ending, basically. I think it's absolutely horrible, and I think it's a crime towards our own population of not taking care of them, and that's a very function of the government, that their function is there to provide a service for the people they're supposed to represent. And it's like we have become secondhand citizens in our own countries, and we don't get nearly anything close enough to what some of these people incoming get. And we, of course, have to pick up the tab. We are the ones who have to pay and ultimately suffer for this.
Yes, it's a hard situation, and for us as the people of the UK, because the government have their levels of control amongst themselves. They have levels of control throughout the press. So everyone is worried about losing their own job. So it's very hard to even express your opinion. Like I'm talking to you now, the conversation we've had now, if I had this in front of my bosses, I would probably be unemployed by Monday.
Yeah.
So it's hard. Then people may have these views themselves, but they can't express them. So again, we're just being pushed into the sides. And then what you're getting then is that people are up in and moving and leaving and going to other places around the world because they can see the collapse of this country. And if someone with a decent financial background probably did the maths, they could work out how long we've got.
Yeah, it's true. They probably could. I know people are looking at that. I know Sweden is in a really bad place when it comes to this. I mean, I don't know how, you know, during the work hours, how either close you are to some of your coworkers, or if you even get an opportunity to sit down and talk with each other in that way. But is there anybody, what's the general atmosphere like? I mean, can you voice these concerns with anybody? And if you did, are they receptive, or do they kind of not want to talk about that?
Most of the guys that I work with, actually firefighters, on a one-to-one conversations, probably feel the same way as I do. They are worried about their families. They're worried about what's going to be around for their children. And they have concerns of what their kids are going to do when they go into the towns on their own, when they're young teenagers, how they're going to be affected by this in the future. Because it's obviously a growing concern now after what happened in Germany at the New Year's Eve. And
yes.
That people don't want to let their children, their younger children or their girls out. So on a one-to-one basis, most people feel, like I do, that there should be something to be done, but what you can actually do is sort of limited, really, apart from, you know, occasionally this is, you know, speaking out against it whenever you can. I've contacted and now been fortunate enough to be able to speak to you, but I have in the past tried to go and speak to the local press, and they're not interested in hearing it. They just want to hear the party line and the political aspect of it, really.
Wow. Is that so? That's amazing. So none of them has found that of interest to speak about what's happening in the tunnel and whatnot?
But they do find it of interest, and they would print the story, but they want all your details so that so they can go back to your bosses to check that you are the person who you claim you are and that you're telling the correct story, at which point your bosses, or my bosses, would say you weren't allowed to go and speak to them, you're out of a job.
Right.
So that's the end of the end of the press interview. The press have also come back and told us that if they go ahead and print any anonymous stories, that then Eurotunnel and the Kent Fire and Rescue Service just cuts them out the loop, won't include them in future briefings or anything else. So they lose their source.
Oh boy, jeez, what a situation, huh? I mean, we had It's been out for about a week or so. We had a story out of Sweden coming out called the Swedish police has something. They have all these subdivisions of codes for different things, and they have a new code called 291, code 291, where the Swedish police actively is covering up information that could lead to, you know, the media or someone else finding out that these are crimes that involves refugees or migrants, which is quite interesting, because it means that the police, the authorities, they know about this stuff, but they're actively trying to cover it up to prevent it, while they're having, you know, changes in the foundational law in Sweden, where they are getting ready to actively being able to deploy military against the people again of their own country. They're even doing training exercises to kind of quell and squash like nationalistic uprisings and stuff like that. I think 2016, Adam, is going to be a really both interesting but also a very, very intense year, and definitely this over the summer, because this is just going to go on the increase. I think more and more of the native European population is going to try to speak up against it as well and start to organizing to stop this from happening. So I don't know, what's your sense of things?
Yeah, I do believe that people will end up taking the law into their own hands is one way of saying it, but it's not the correct way. It's basically it's forming a large enough group of people that you get listened to. So which is always the hardest thing. One thing I know for certain is my wife and my children, we are actively looking at ways that we will protect our house and our household against anything. And I know other people that are doing a very similar thing. Well, it starts off there. Then the next thing is you'll want to protect your street. Then it'll be your neighbourhood. And so that it will build slowly. The more trouble there is, the more rapid trouble there is, the more rapid the rise in there will be of people eventually saying, look, no, enough's enough. The police aren't doing anything, so we may have to. So, yeah, I can see it this year, especially this next year, are being a problem, because I think those migrants this year will just have no impunity. They will just think, right, let's just go for it, because if they do shut the door properly, we would have missed out. And that's where I think there's going to be a huge increase.
Is this what you wanted to do as a firefighter? I mean, do you miss your old job, so to speak? I mean, have you thought about maybe moving to another area so that you can get back into fighting fires as opposed to immigrants?
Yeah, I've definitely thought of that. I've thought about the moving away completely from Kent. The layout of Kent is such as a county that's surrounded on three sides by the sea, and down the centre of it, there are two main roads, two motorways, one at the north, one at the south. And in between those two is where I live. And from London to Folkestone, in between those two motorways, is basically just being infilled with housing and all sorts of infrastructure. So every single area gets an increase of people, an increase of migrants there. And I am in the process of thinking, right, well, I need to move away from this area now into an area that's just so out the way that we won't be touched or dealt with like this for many, many years. As for the firefighting side of work, I think just moving out of the way from any of the bigger cities is probably your most beneficial thing. People that I know that work in the larger towns as firefighters, most of the work that they'd actually do go to now is migrant-based on a different level, because it's the migrants that are causing the fires, because they're living they're the ones living in the more run-down conditions. They don't perhaps look after things themselves, or they do things that are way different from what we do in the UK, so they end up having fires. No, as for Eurotunnel, Eurotunnel itself, I think, will just end up being a glorified security job.
Oh boy, what a story! Huh? What a way to to develop. It's just surreal for me thinking about what is happening to Europe and the way that it's transforming so quickly. You know, what is there anything else you think that we should know about? You know, either in direct relation to the tunnel and the job you're doing, or basically anything else that's on your mind about all the things we've been talking about here?
Not really. I think we've covered most of it. All it was for me, a way of letting people know that to listen to your show that the migrants are coming through that tunnel, yeah, say on average 150 a day, the illegal ones, into the UK, and that's every day, every single day, and the press reports occasionally on a few, and so people forget, people go about their lives and they don't think about it. But for me, it's an outstanding figure that has somehow has got to stop at some point.
Absolutely, it is. You're absolutely right. Well, thank you so much for sharing this with us, Adam. I really appreciate it, so we can get a perspective into what things are like on the inside, what's been happening at the tunnel. I remember earlier this year we heard so much about it. We keep posting the stories. We're wondering what's happening, what's going on. So this has been really, good for us to be able to understand what's happening on the inside. So, if you will, please, keep us informed and keep us in mind as well in terms of what's going on. And maybe we can speak more again in the future if things change radically at the tunnel.
I will do. I say thank you so much for letting me come on and speak. But I should imagine this following year I'll probably have some updates for you.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Adam.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well, before we close here, I just wanted to let you know that we have a Canadian roundtable on Wednesday with Arthur Topham to speak about his trial in Canada. Also joining in on that, we have Paul Fromm, Gila Datsman, Brian Ruha, and possibly Jason Erb. We also have a show coming up on the Zika virus and why you should never take the vaccine, ever. We also have the Asa True Roundtable a bit further ahead. We have a show with Bob Whitaker and Tom Bowie, and we also recorded an hour with Gerald Celente, so we have much more coming here soon. I hope you enjoyed the show today. My thanks again to Adam for speaking with us, and also to you for listening. Don't forget, if you like what we do, sign up for a membership at redeyesmembers.com and get access to exclusive second hour material, 10 years of radio shows. We also have videos, inside episodes, films, and much more. You can help spread the word about the show, share it with family and friends, follow us on the social networks, and don't forget to stay in touch. Now, if you are in an area and like to speak out, similar to what Adam did today, get in touch with us, redeyescreations@gmail.com, and we might just want to cover it. Okay, we'll talk more soon. Have a great rest of your day, and take good care.